You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildopedia. Joining us today is Melissa Naber from Sky Planning. Thanks for joining us, Mel.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me back on, Matt.
Can we call you a friend of Buildopedia?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what's been happening? Give us an update. So Mel, hang on. Let me give you an intro, a better intro. Mel is a town planner. She has a company called Sky Planning. She consults on development and writes reports and helps plans get approved, get through council. And she's also a representative of YIMBY, which she can tell you about. YIMBY, the Yes in My Backyard counter to the NIMBY. So yeah, what have you been up to, Mel? Tell us more.
Thanks for that intro. Yeah, you know what? It's nearly this October will be 4 years that I've been running Sky Planning. So it's been a great journey. I love it. What have I been up to? I have just been away to Barcelona, actually, which was fascinating from a planning perspective. So that was really interesting. So I'd love to kind of share a bit about my findings there. But I was also just on a business owner side of it. I was super happy because it was my first overseas trip since I launched the company, and I was very pleased to not come back to any fires or project problems. My team is absolutely amazing, so thank you to them. Massive shout out.
They are great. They are very good. You're very lucky. So tell us about Barcelona. Barcelona, tell us, what did you see? What's the highlights? What did you learn?
Yeah, you know what? I'm such an urban nerd. Probably one of the main highlights for me was going to the history museum and the planning, and like, oh, not the planning, but I suppose, you know, the history of how the town and urbanization unfolded. And it was really cool for two reasons. One is there were two parts to it. One was like the history, which unfolded, which you walked through, and there was all information like a typical museum, but you know, they started they started BC, right? So we went from the first century, second, third, fourth, fifth. It was just fascinating. And then the other part of the museum was like underground ruins. So Barcelona today was actually built on top of the original Barcelona, which had a different name back then, which eludes me now. But it was just amazing. So you could actually, they've dug them out and you go down underground and you walk around and you see the remnants of this town, and they explain to you what happened there. It was very cool. And just something less urban, I suppose it is urban related, but not physical form, more about social structures and the economy. Did you know that the 8-hour working week was born in Barcelona?
Yeah, I may have read it in a book that I read recently, and it was Humanize by Thomas Heatherwick, and he started his intro with Barcelona. So maybe it was in there, or maybe I, but yeah, so I, his premise was around, I don't know if you've seen the book or heard of the book, but it's all about the catastrophe, as he calls it, of boring architecture. Boring buildings. And he points to Barcelona and the struggle of, well, its most famous person, arguably, if not most famous, definitely its most famous architect, but arguably its most famous single person, Antonio Gaudí, who crafted many spectacular buildings, apartment buildings, and broke every law possible to get his building, and argued to get his buildings through, because they all broke council regulation. They were all outliers. Anyway, that's the premise.
Not in keeping with the existing character.
That's right. And yet some of the world's great buildings emerged from that.
Have we learned nothing?
So what else did you learn from the museum of the history museum, from a planning perspective? What lessons can we take from Barcelona?
Yeah, you know what? They went through their own housing shortage and crisis, which is obviously very relevant to us today here in Sydney and across Australia. And it was solved with building a lot of public housing, but also it was solved with allowing new housing typologies to be built. And one of the ones that I found quite interesting was allowing, they called it the quarter apartment, and it was 30 square meters that were being apartments being built on top of existing buildings to allow for like infill within the existing urban areas where people need to live for work and for other commitments and other reasons. So I thought that was really interesting. And the controls that we're dealing with here in terms of planning are so restrictive to certain housing typologies. It doesn't allow for different types to be built, smaller or various kinds and alternative living styles. And certainly building on top of existing buildings. I mean, Airspace has done some fantastic work in this space, excuse the pun, but more needs to be done, because we should really be allowing, you know, more infill on top of our existing buildings, you know, even if it is just one or two stories. You know, it doesn't need to be high rises that towering over us. And, you know, I often have clients say to me like, oh, next door is higher than my building, surely I should be able to go up on my property. And it's like, well, actually that was built under a previous more relaxed planning scheme. So why are our controls getting tighter and tighter when we're in a housing crisis? I think this is something we can look at. And certainly the mini apartments on top of existing buildings that Barcelona did are something we could look to.
And relate that, because if I'm not wrong, you said 30 square meters, relate that back to planning law in Australia or in New South Wales. Like where does that sit? How is that different?
Oh, forget about it. You know, forget about it. They wouldn't allow that. But I mean, look, maybe it does need to be a little bit bigger. That's fine. But I think just having a general rethink about the controls and how restrictive they are to allow alternative types of living is something we need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, I really I highly recommend Thomas Heatherwick's book. I asked him to come on the podcast and he said, how many listeners have you got? And I said, not many. He declined politely. But one day, Thomas, if you're out there, I just said, I loved your book. It's so good. It's so good. As a non-architect, I get everything he says. Like, I get it. And anyway, that's enough of that rabbit hole. But so Barcelona and what else?
I went to see a library in one of the more suburban areas, I suppose you would call it, and it won an award last year for best library of the world. And so I thought I better go see that. And it was really gorgeous and it was done really well. And it just really reminded me of the, you know, a lot of people are saying that books are redundant and so forth, but libraries still have a place in our communities and in our cities. And they certainly are more than just books, right? They are places they allow universal access to knowledge. And so the importance of those, putting that type of public infrastructure, particularly in lower socioeconomic areas, is absolutely vital to helping to raise the quality of life for the people living there. And this library certainly did that. And it was really great to see people using it and in different ways. And it reminded me of a theory that was done by the mayor of a little town or a city in Brazil. And he decided that rather than having one central library, he was going to put 50 libraries, smaller ones, right throughout this town called Curubita. And the idea was that every child would be within walking distance of a library. So, yeah, it was really great to see that, and just to see that, be reminded that libraries are more than books. They're not redundant, and they can be key focal points for our communities to come together and to thrive. It was beautiful.
And Mel, because we're on a podcast, you're going to have to describe something about the library. Like, was it about the library that was special? Or like, what was it?
Yeah, the architectural design was gorgeous, right? So lots of natural light, lots of light colors, wood, and different ways to segregate different areas using curtains, like light curtains. There was hammocks spread throughout it. There was cool computer areas, lots of chill out areas, bean bags for kids, you know, you name it, all that kind of stuff that allow for people to use the space in different ways. It was great. I will do a blog post, so I'll put the photos up.
Yeah, cool. And I guess that sounds like a place for teenagers to go and make out, potentially.
I love how your mind goes there. Yes, I would say it would be a place to...
I was a teenager once.
I'm sure there would be...
Went to a library.
Yep. Okay, yep.
Anyway, all right, enough about my teenage years.
Tell me what's been happening with you.
Well, I've been busy writing a book, which has occupied my headspace, and it's amazing the moment that you commit to writing something, how hard it is to write anything. I can spit out ideas and blogs when I'm not supposed to, when I'm supposed to be doing something else, but somehow the minute it's a book, it's so hard to sit and focus. Everything else, I've got so many other things done, it's amazing, but I've got a deadline and I don't know, I'm going to have to power through. And so let me tell you about the book. It's essentially a guide to planning in inner suburbs, or specifically in the inner west, because that's the area that I know well, or we know well within our business. But there's not really much out there. I mean, we had a consultation with a client the other day, and they had this funny book on planning that was obviously written by planners for planners, and he was trying to make sense of it and relate it to his experience and the day-to-day of planning and what we were saying, and it was impossible. It was like two different languages from a different time. So what we're trying to do is a practical guide that explains and lifts the curtain on the planning process.
A practical guide for a system that is not practical. You've got your work cut out for you there, Matt.
That's right. That's right. And what we've focused on is what is the lived experience and what actually happens, rather than what technically is supposed to be, right? We've tried to go, here's what you're going to be up for, and here's a practical guide. Don't worry about this bit. Won't make sense. Here's how to do it. Here's what you need to know, because otherwise you'll be very frustrated. So we've taken that, but it's a cut through from, takes you on, it's a little bit Buildopedia in that it takes you on the property journey from purchase of a property pitched at homeowners, single homeowners, not developers. Developers already know everything, so we're not even going to bother. But we're pretty much really enjoyed it. And a lot of it is just putting blogs that we've released over a long time into some sort of order, and ordering the information and filling in the gaps, or putting together, you know, adding workshops that we've done. And for example, we do a planning workshop for real estate agents that provides visually planning constraints and planning law in a visual way. So we're putting that in the book. So I've had a lot of fun, but a few questions have arisen as a result. And one of those questions that came up that I was trying, in the course of trying to, funny you should say, how are you trying to make practical something that isn't practical? Well, so this question came up, and why is it so hard to get things through council, through a DA process, that is? Not, we're not talking about complying development, which is an automated system. We're talking about a development application. Why does it feel like it's easier to get a decision in court than it is in council that's favorable to the developer? And it was one of those illogical things that I started to explain and struggled. So, yeah, you're bang on. There's limitations to practicality. So what I did, of course, is put it out on LinkedIn and got a lot of responses. Kim, our marketing manager, also reposted it on Facebook, and we got a lot of responses that we're not going to talk about, you know, because they're very mean to count. There was nothing positive said about council, and that's all we'll say. Thanks particularly Dennis Turkovich for your insights, but they're not repeatable, mostly. Very, very, on Facebook, different level of animosity and candor towards council planning. And on LinkedIn, we got, you know, we had a few responses that I'll unpack and some suggestions, but I guess, I don't know, what's your take on it? Because I started second guessing myself. I started going, Is that really easier? It feels like it's easier when you're in a hearing in court. There's a different level. Things that get stopped in council go through in court. Everyone kind of knows this. But then I started going, well, is this actually true? Because it feels a lot like it. But is this objectively a thing? Am I hallucinating? What's going on? Do you know what I mean? I started second guessing myself because it felt a bit absurd. So anyway, I'll let you give us your take on it.
Look, it's complicated and layered and multifaceted, and I don't think there's one single reason. But I do always find it weird when you go out, say, to a Section 34 conference on site, and the commissioner will...
You'll have to tell us what that is.
So it's when you've got a refusal or a deemed refusal and you're going to court, and there's an option to find agreement before it gets to a hearing so that you can actually go out on site. And it's often that the commissioner will preface these meetings with, now, this isn't like when you're doing a DA, we're here to work together. You know, like, oh, what? So it's almost like there's this unspoken written approach to DAs, which are to say no and to find the reasons to say no and to get it out of council's assessment pipeline as fast as possible. There is no on-site meeting with the applicant or the owner. You know, the council will go out and do their own inspection on their own. There is no formal part in the process to meet with the council and put forward the proposal and maybe therefore negotiate on something. It's all very up behind walls, particularly with the planning portal now. So the council will look at the application and then put through a request for more information without actually talking to the applicant about what the proposal is. And so, you know, reasons for why things were done a certain way get lost. And there just seems to be this, I think the actual process and the way it works means that there's no real way for the applicant and the council to work together. So things get lost in translation. There's barriers that are put up. And it's not until you get to sort of a reasonable place of, okay, well, we're appealing this, let's meet on site and have a good old chat about it and see where we can find a compromise, that anything gets done or through. That's one of the problems.
So what you're saying is that I'm not hallucinating. It does... That feeling that it's easier in court than it is, or in land environment court in a hearing, than it is in council. That's not just my assumption that might be skewed. It's actually reasonably accepted in planning circles.
It's certainly my lived experience.
Yeah. I think a few of the responses, and particularly Justin Geddy, who he's a property developer in Melbourne, he was on our podcast some time ago. His sentiment reflects what you're saying. Council planners tend to approach applications with a mindset of how can we refuse this application as opposed to getting it approved. So that correlates. I guess other people say, well, it's just corruption, you know, they create a corrupt system so that you have to pay to get... Well, I'm paraphrasing or maybe skewing what was said, but there's certainly a theme of it's corrupt and it's broken, and developers with money get favorable treatment.
I wish that was the case.
I guess you would be very naive to approval. Yeah, you'd be naive to think there is no corruption. Of course, there's corruption. As to whether it's a real driver of the system, I'm not sure. Like, I think that there's always in any system, you presume there's some corruption. As to whether that's tilting the whole system, I'm not sure. I don't know what your thoughts on that would be.
Yeah, I agree with you. From my experience, I don't think that this is a problem that needs to be resolved and that is causing the systemic issues that we're all facing as an industry. But something else that did just drop into my mind then, because I just saw it yesterday, is that, and in council's defence, in local council's defence, is that they do have a shortage of planners. They are understaffed. And the shocking statistic I saw yesterday, which was released by the Planning Institute of Australia, of which I'm a long-term member, is that the eighth university course on town planning has just closed. So people are not choosing it as a profession, and as a result, universities are no longer even teaching planning. This is a serious problem. This is something that the government, state government, needs to look at, and also more funding needs to be provided to local councils to recruit great talent, because if we don't have good people assessing applications that don't have the expertise, they're going to err on the side of caution and risk because they don't have the expertise to be able to assess it at that higher level. I'm worried.
Yeah, so that's when you say the eighth, is it the eighth to close or the eighth out, like meaning that we're down to seven now in the country?
The eighth to close. I don't know how many town planning courses are still being run. I'd have to look at that, but they're the eight.
Yeah, right. But they're closing en masse.
Yeah.
Yeah, shortage of town planners. But is there a different way to look at this? Because, I mean, I kind of think, look, town planning is important, but is an experienced architect any less qualified? And I don't know the answer. I'm not presuming anything, but I'm thinking a senior builder, a builder with a lot of experience, definitely knows more about architecture than a brand new, fresh architect. I can tell you that because I've lived that experience. And okay, they may not have the technical skills to operate CAD, but certainly a builder who's been involved and had a lot of experience in architecture knows more. But is it the same for planning and architects? Like maybe they're looking in the wrong place. What if experienced like engineers, architects, or other professions filled that space? Would they do a better job? And are they looking in the right place? Could they outsource to private practitioners? I reckon, Mel, you could knock over 12 DAs in about 8 hours.
Well, you've actually hit the nail on the head for another issue, isn't it? You know, we are dealing with government agencies, right? So there's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of red tape. You know, there's more efficiencies that you due to the commercial realities that businesses have to face. It's just the nature of the system. So, yeah, I do think that it would be more efficient for consultant planners to be assessing DAs, but I've seen delays when that happens as well, because that does happen currently. And I have been held up because a consultant planner took, you know, almost as long, if not longer, than council to approve something. So, you know, and then even worse, and you can't call them directly. So you've got to call the council, leave a message, and then the consultant planner gets the message from council and then contacts you. So it almost puts up more barriers. I don't know, but there could be something to look into there, yeah.
Well, yeah, now that I think about it, my only experience with a consultant planner who was an ex-planner who went into a consulting role was not great. It felt like they were milking fees, to be honest. It felt like they were exacerbating and extending, and they wanted to pad their fees out. Because that's the only way I can explain the quite irrational thing that went on in terms of pre-hearing and in-hearing a case that there was no chance for council to win, and yet they pursued it. So yeah, I guess that I've answered my own question. Bad idea. Stop. Unless it's Mel.
Exactly.
Only Mel can assess DAs from now. But yeah, I don't know. Like, what about architects though? What about employing, okay, contract that there's problems, governance problems, arguably corruption problems with private contractors, but what about architects? Can architects fill a planning role?
I mean, you got to also think, do architects want to fill a planning role? Because it's quite a different profession. It's quite not, what I mean is the day-to-day execution of the job is very different. If an architect wants to be an architect and then they're suddenly box ticking as a planner, I don't know, are we getting recruitment into that role? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But stepping back, how did we get to a system where it's easier? Because when you think about the legal system more broadly, the further you go into the legal system, well, no one really wins. If you're in court, it's just who loses the most normally. But if you think about the legal system generally, or whether it's criminal law or anything else, that the higher the court, or the more you progress the court, the higher the level of proof, the harder, from a novice perspective, from an outsider, I'm not a lawyer, but from an outside perspective, there's a perception that the further you go up the chain to the high court, the higher the burden of proof, the more you have to argue the case and reference law. Whereas in between council approvals and land environment court, it feels like it's the other way around somehow. So, I mean, how did we get to that?
No, I know it's a good question, and I think I've got a clear answer for you. I think it's because of politics. So councils, they are in their very mandate required to listen to the concerns of their existing residents. So they have a less broad social interest beyond outside their own LGA. And so should their constituents not be wanting any more development, then that is the side that councils will err on, whereas the court is removed from this political imposition and it's more neutral. What do you think about that? Am I onto something?
That's right. And the court is state government managed, I guess, for lack of a better description. It's the state government appoints commissioners to the Land Environment Court, if I'm not mistaken. And so it's a pro-development. State governments tend to be more pro-development than local governments. But I often wonder, and we haven't had your YIMBY update yet, but I often wonder how, you know, in the whole NIMBY YIMBY perspective, like I think the NIMBY and the general opposition, particularly to a ambiguous extension to a family home, not ambiguous, but not an impactful development by any standard, with minimal objections. Why is that sometimes so hard? Surely there's not a political will of the people to oppose that fourth bedroom and ensuite. Like it's not, even some of the neighbours aren't opposing it at times. So why is council so focused on opposing? What's that? There's got to be more than just politics, because I know, like, my experience of living in the inner west is that most people are very happy for their neighbors to build their home, extend their home. Of course, there are people who are going to be unhappy but it's mostly because they're going to have concrete trucks in their street and other things that will interrupt their life. If you unpack it to precisely, they're more unhappy with disruption in the street than they are with that specific extension. So why is that oppositional stance there? It's got to be more than just will of the constituents, right?
Sure, in some cases. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Look, I've often thought that another layer to this is it's become a cultural it's a cultural thing. It's a mindset. And I believe that it's just a monster that's grown out of control. A cultural monster that's grown out of control, and that they feel that they're not doing their job unless they are picking something to pieces or saying no. That's what my outside interpretation. Now, I can't speak with authority on that because I've never worked inside a council. I've always worked on the private side. But I have heard from various people who've worked at council that they feel that they cannot side with the applicant or the developer or the homeowner, that they can't do that. They can't encourage it, help it, support it, that they need to be legitimately executing their job properly. It's got to be a no, and it's got to be a barrier.
Yeah, right. So look, I think that's fair. I think it is a cultural systemic thing. How do we break it down? And I mean, on our last podcast we had, we focused on wacky ideas for improving, more so for improving the process, but what specifically with that cultural barrier and that sort of negative mindset, what can be done, if anything, to break that? Because I know, like, even the elected councillors are frustrated. I've spoken to them and they are frustrated with it. So I guess that maybe supports my earlier point that it's not just the politics of the community and trying to do what the community is. It goes beyond that, because even the elected officials are frustrated by their own system. But what is that one thing that can be done?
Yeah, it's interesting. We recently had a ministerial direction sent out from the Planning Minister Paul Scully to all the councils saying, guys, we're in a housing crisis and I want you to make sure that you are executing your job with that in a pro-housing way, and that to look, you know, to make sure that housing development proposals that are for more housing, you know, that you looking at them favourably, as long as you still obviously meet the controls and you still need to do your fair assessment, but that we need to acknowledge we're in a housing crisis. I don't think that that letter did anything. And what I would really like to see is I would love to see training, to see regular in-depth training for town planners inside council to understand the importance of their job, that, you know, they are, it's absolutely vital to the economy, to society, to housing people, to even for businesses. Their job is so important, and how they choose to assess something makes all the difference in our communities and our lives. And they need to be doing that in a way that is wanting to work with the applicant. And I think they need to feel that they are allowed to do that. At the moment, I think they're feeling that they can't. I think that needs to change. But I think that can only change through targeted training that's frequent and that builds a new culture. That's it. I would love to see the state government roll that out to every single council.
And I'm just riffing off of that, like, Mel, you and I attended a workshop with Inner West Council, particularly, and, well, it wasn't just you and I, by the way, there was a room full of planning and design professionals from the Inner West. It wasn't just for the record, it wasn't just Mel, myself and the mayor, there were others. But one of the things that, there's a lot of angry people there and a lot of good, very good things came out. I'm not sure that much happened, but I think one thing that stood out for me was reading the council's objectives, reading the document that spelled out what they did and why. And I don't remember exactly what was in it. There was a whole bunch of rambly, techie words and management speak. But the one thing that was missing in my mind that was very, like, it was plain as day that there was something wrong with this document. One thing that was missing was any relation to creation of value. There was nothing about creating value for the community, nothing about creating value for the homeowner. And I'm kind of think, and of course I raised that, and then I raised that at a subsequent council meeting that I was invited to. And, I just think everyone looked at me and went, like, all right, next. They looked at me like I was an alien because I suggested that value was a thing. And I'm not talking about dollar value. I'm talking about value of life, value of street improvement. But like I'm talking about, because as a builder and a developer and a that in planning somewhat, it's all about value creation. The whole thing is driven by creating value and understanding for your client, for whoever comes to see you, what is the thing that they value and how do we create the most value? You know, that's the whole business. That's our business, creating value for people. There's nothing about that. It's all about approval speak and technical things, but there's nothing about value creation. And I think some councils are better than others at establishing value. How much does, or contribution, well, that, I guess value in planning speak is contribution to the street, right? But it's very one-dimensional from how does the building look in the street and how does the street look before and look after, rather than how people move or how people, like what happens or how people interact, like, or what that greater, broader value is. It's certainly like, feels like the value is one-dimensional based on what you can see from the outside in, from a particular spot across the street.
Totally. And I'm even thinking about like the value that the occupants of that dwelling will bring to their local community or the local economy. That's exactly right. It is very one-dimensional. It doesn't look at the systemic benefits that can happen as a result of a proposal.
Yeah. And we've just had council elections. So has anything changed? What have the IMBYs been up to, I guess?
Yeah, sure. Well, we ran a campaign really looking to use the elections as to put a focus on housing. You know, we are in a housing crisis, and it is our local councils that approve or refuse development applications. So we really wanted to make sure that we were getting an outcome where local councillors were being voted in that were pro-housing and that were actually concerned about the housing crisis and making sure that more houses were delivered so that the city can survive this crisis without losing all the 30 and 40-year-olds, as an example, to other cities, or losing all of the essential workers to other cities. So, yeah, we were really focused on doing that. We had a pledge for councillors to sign prior to the election that said that they would support proposals for more housing, which was really great. So, yeah, it's been a busy time for us. And I think the NIMBY councils were called out in the papers, which was really great to see. And I hope that that continues, because the only way we're going to solve this housing crisis is by building more houses. So the time for anti-development or saying that, you know, we don't need more houses or that put them somewhere else, the not in my backyard sayers, like that, the time has ended.
And I had a chat to Mary Lynn Taylor, who's a lawyer. She must be well into her 70s, and it sounds like she's never going to retire. And she's a lawyer at Bardia Perry, and I met her at a function. And I just said, Mary Lynn, do you think, how big a thing are NIMBYs? Like, is NIMBY a real thing? And she just went, nah, I don't think so. She just doesn't. She thinks that the effect of NIMBYs, or it's a crutch. Well, I'm putting words in her mouth now, but I think she just said, nah, it's not a big, there's not a big NIMBY contingent. She said it's not as big as everyone thinks it is.
I find that such a curious statement for many levels, but there are countless resident action groups, Save Our Suburbs, that are well-oiled machine that you put in one development for anything and you will get objections start flooding in. And the councils, as part of their mandate, have to listen to that.
Yeah, well, but I guess that's on a bigger scale, bigger developments, but day-to-day council, okay, maybe I should have prefaced that with like day-to-day council operation and the average DA, we don't get, like, there's the odd person who's just unhappy about concrete trucks in the street, really, when it boils down to, and occasionally someone is fearful of something happening next door that they don't fully understand, or there might be marginal overshadowing, but when you unpack, and I guess we don't do anything that we think is going to disrupt neighbors' lives, right? We if someone wants to do a four-story development that's going to overshadow and destroy their neighbor's life, we're probably not going to be involved in that. But we don't really feel that day-to-day NIMBYism is a factor in the average DA, right?
I think you're right. I think it depends on the proposal and where it comes into play, definitely.
But you're seeing it. At what level do you start seeing that well-oiled machine?
You can see that well-oiled machine gear up all the time. It's constantly in the papers. Well, you know what was really interesting when I first started this YIMBY journey was that I had journalists ringing me saying, thank you. They said, this is the first time in 20 years that I've been reporting on urban issues that I've ever written an article that says, we welcome this development. All the time, for 20 years, I've been reporting on, no, I don't want to see this development. Residents oppose local development proposal, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I think you can see it for a variety of things across Sydney. And you know, if you pick up the papers, you're bound to see something about it. Some local residents saying, no, they don't want to see something. It's kind of endless. Facebook groups never stop. So I think that it is out there. You know, I just think it's particularly sad when you see it happening for larger scale developments where lots of apartments are being proposed, even for essential workers. I saw one recently happen in North Sydney, Crow's Nest, like that, which was going to provide housing for doctors, and huge local opposition, rife. And you just think, how is this possible? We've been doing a lot of work with the Nurses and Midwives Association, and the stories that come out of their people having to sleep in their cars because they can't afford somewhere to live or doing double shifts. We even heard where equipment in our hospitals is at half being used at half capacity because there's not enough staff to run the equipment, so we can't get MRIs done or other CT scans or whatever it might be. I mean, it's absolute madness.
Yeah, I guess on the flip side, if you're a skeptical, with my full skeptic hat on, YIMBYs, and I know a few of them, and I know they're very passionate about housing, but is there an element within YIMBYs that is just big developers and kind of like going, rubbing their hands together going, oh, we love Mel. She's doing us a great favor here.
I wish, look, my company is so small. I don't work for big developers. I don't have, you know, I don't have huge clients on my list. I'm really more about smaller developments and infill development. That's really where most of my work is.
So you're a puppet for big developers and you don't even know and don't even...
I mean, you could draw those correlations if you want, Matt, but I can tell you that, I mean, first of all, YIMBYs don't take any membership or donation from any developers. We just distance ourselves. I mean, everyone that works there are volunteers and, or works there, I should say, everyone who's part of the group are volunteers and genuinely concerned about, and all have their own stories, right? Whether they're renters who have had to move back in with their parents, or families who have lost grandparents, can't afford to live in the city, or whatever. Everyone's got their own story, you know, and it really is sad to see. But I think that there's got to be change in this city, and there are people who will stand up and say, we want that change, and are fighting for it. And that's why we're seeing younger people going, sorry, NIMBYs, who have been ruling this town for however many years. It's our turn. We want housing. We want a progressive city.
And I am winding you up. I am, in fact, a member of the YIMBYs. And although, oh, my God, you guys nerd out so much on the, like, I can't really,
Discord.
On the Discord, I just go, oh, my God, this is just such, there is, if you ever want to see a planning nerd out, it's amazing in a good way. I just, you know, it's sometimes over my head. I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
There's a lot of passionate urban nerds in our group. That's for sure.
It's extraordinary. Some of the discussions extraordinary.
Great. I just think it's fantastic. Town planning is having a movement. Unfortunately, it's not for the right reasons, but it is, you know, this housing crisis has really brought to the fore that town planning is integral to our lives and that urban matters do matter, you know. So I think from that perspective, it's good. We just need more town planners now. We just need people to actually go and do a course.
Yeah. Well, I'm signed up. Sure. Sign me up.
We're a rare species, these town planners these days.
I guess that's good for you, for your business, right? In some ways, you're a rare species and you're sought after. But I know that, I mean, from my perspective, we do well. We're the go-to when things don't go right for a lot of customers. And I guess that doesn't bring me any joy. Like, we're kind of, we'd just rather be doing good work than rescuing distraught or clients or failed DAs because they're just put through the ringer for very good reason, I have to say. But some things were never going to get through council because they were very unreasonable. But yeah, a lot of the time there are people asking for reasonable things and this dual track system. And I think that the thing that I don't like about it, the sad thing about it is that it does work against people who aren't wealthy, the clients who really, for whom going to court, putting an application into the Environment Court is just not an option. They can't do it, but it's not a possibility. That's the real disaster. It creates a dual track system where people who have the money, and I guess, yeah, that's the way to do it, is slip in your, at 42 days upon deemed refusal, slip in your application to Land Environment Court, and then council start listening to you finally, right? But there's a fee for that, there's a cost, and that makes development prohibitive. So that's the unfortunate part of it. So what that's left me on a very sad note, I feel like we have to finish on some sort of high. So I guess, what else is the solution? What else can we do apart from everybody joining the YIMBY group? What else can people do that are listening to the podcast, and what else is something that can change things?
Yeah, I mean, we've got the pattern book coming out, the state government's working on. I think if that's done in the right way and making sure that the designs are going to stack up in terms of feasibility and not be, you know, exorbitant to actually build and are cost efficient so that they do get built, I think that could be a really great way forward for our city, because it means we're going to get really high quality developments. And yeah, the council.
Hang on, Mel. I'm going to have to ask you. You're going to have to tell us what the pattern book is. It's not, we're not making jumpers, right? you may need to explain, because you and I know what we're talking about. Just explain.
State government has put out an international design competition to create designs for medium density housing. So dual occupancies and small flat apartments and the like. And that will be a chosen design or a number of designs that then the industry can come to that they can pull off the shelf and get it fitted for their own site, and then submit that to we don't know if it's going to be council or the state yet, but it will be fast-tracked, and that will then be able to be constructed. So it means we're getting high-quality designs that smaller developers or mum and dads don't need to actually go and get an architect for, and also, technically speaking, they should come onto the market faster because they're not going through a lengthy approval process. They're already pre-approved, essentially.
So is this sort of like project homes for three-story buildings or four-story? Is this what we're sort of saying, let's do the project home model? I wonder if there was a pattern. There must have been pattern books in the past, because I know that if I look at a particular street in Balmain, it looks exactly the same as a particular street in Paddington, looks very similar to a particular street in Glebe. So we must have had something like this before because of that role, particularly two-story terraces, right? Or a lot of other, or one-story terraces in some places. But yeah, that two-story terrace, that's a design that feels like it was a pattern. Or the fact that there's every house from a particular era that you walk into, you already know there's going to be two rooms in the front and a fireplace, and then it's going to get wider as you go through, right? So this must have been something, I don't know, you might not know, but it just occurred to me that actually.
No, you are onto something there, Matt. When I went to the pattern book design competition launch, the state government also allowed us to walk around the mint where they had the old pattern books, exactly what you're talking about. We got to flick through them and have a look at them, and it was amazing. So, yes, this is not a new idea, an idea that has worked before. So I think it's a great way because, you know, obviously sometimes there are genuine concerns of poor development coming into our city, and we have seen that, right? So I think what's great about this is that it means that we're going to get high-quality development. And so that's what's really exciting. So that's a positive thing.
Yeah. Why don't they just use the old pattern books? Why are they making new ones?
Oh, I think lifestyles have changed.
Yes. Materials have
changed. We've got to have, that's the other thing, you know, the way that we live and work and play is so different now. More and more people are working from home. So we just need more space at home these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I don't think we should use the old ones, but I think it's a concept, but it's in a funny way. There's almost a pattern book, a virtual pattern book with every old terrace house. Everyone wants to widen the back of it where it narrows and put a living area that connects with the backyard. So I think there's always like a pattern book virtually that's happened. But I would be really interested to see what the outcomes are, what those winning designs are. Yeah, it'd be very, very interesting. So, all right, no worries. We better wrap it up. Thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on. We'd love to have you on again soon, as we called it earlier.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm really excited to see your book. I can't wait. So keep me posted.
I'll be furiously typing away and dictating away the next month or so until we get it out. But it'll be an ebook. It'll be available in about a month's time, and would love your feedback on it. We'll see how it goes. So thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating and help other listeners find the podcast. Thanks so much, and we'll see you for the next episode.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.